there's a lot of fear and suspicion around natural gas infrastructure in our region. From residents protesting injection wells where fracking wastewater is placed underground.
I mean, that is plain and simple poison that they're pumping into the ground.
To fears over pipelines exploding near homes and schools.
You know, you're aware that it's there, and you just go about your day like all the other things that could befall a person. A car accident, a lightning strike.
I'm Kara Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, the fears and realities of living with the shale gas industry. Plus, some veterans in West Virginia say they were promised a shot at farming on an abandoned coal field, but their new future never materialized.
Now I'm feeling pretty misled, and I also feel a little bit exploited.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. We've reported a lot here on the show and on our Trump on Earth podcast about President Donald Trump's emphasis on deregulation. Well, he promised even more environmental deregulation at an event in Philadelphia recently, where he spoke to a group of electricians at the Pennsylvania Convention Center. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports.
President Trump began his talk by telling the National Electrical Contractors Association that he had, quote, paid them so much money over the years, referring to his career as a builder. As president, Trump has worked to get rid of environmental regulations. He told the contractors that will mean more business.
And we're producing energy-rich Pennsylvania shale. To get you more contracts and more jobs, we've slashed a record number of regulations.
The Trump administration has proposed reversing Obama-era restrictions on air emissions from oil and gas operations.
We took regulations off which allowed us to do things that we would never have been able to do. Think of it, we're the single largest producer of energy in the world. Did you ever think you were going to hear that?
The Electrical Contractors Association supports more natural gas pipelines, but the group also backs renewables and upgrades to the country's transmission lines. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
A bill in front of Pennsylvania lawmakers would establish tougher penalties for people who vandalize pipelines, power plants, and other, quote, critical infrastructure facilities. It also targets people who trespass with the intent to damage such property. Republicans who have supported the measure say it's necessary to punish people who commit crimes that affect the greater community, like cutting a fiber optic line that provides internet and phone service. Representative John Marr from southwestern Pennsylvania chairs a House committee that advanced the bill. He says the new charges would fall between two extremes.
Having a petty trespassing or a terrorism charge as the only two options seems to be leaving our prosecutors a bit scratching their heads.
Democrats who oppose the bill, environmentalists, and civil liberties groups have expressed concern that the proposed penalties are too severe and that the bill impedes upon First Amendment protest rights. A number of states in the past few years have considered similar measures as protests over pipelines have become more frequent. One reason people protest pipelines is because they're afraid of them. In September, major explosions involving gas pipelines rocked communities near Pittsburgh and Boston, causing evacuations, destroying homes, injuring dozens of people, and killing a young man. Dangerous incidents are rare, but Pennsylvania is in the midst of a pipeline building boom, and the particularly controversial Mariner East 2 pipeline is supposed to come online soon. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick has more on why our brains are wired to be wary of certain things like pipelines.
Phil Stober runs an organic farm in Lebanon County. It's right next to the new Mariner East 2 pipeline. When the line is fully up and running, it will transport natural gas liquids 350 miles across the southern part of the state.
You know, you're aware that it's there, and you just go about your day like all the other things that could befall a person. A car accident, a lightning strike, you know, a terrorist attack that we're all aware of nowadays. It's just one more element to think about.
He said he laughed out loud when the company building it sent him a mailer with its evacuation plan. Energy Transfer Partners warned that he would not be able to see or smell a leak, but he must avoid creating any kind of spark, even ringing a doorbell, and head upwind, away from an invisible, odorless cloud of highly flammable things like ethane, propane, and butane.
The information you get from Sunoco, Energy Transfer Partners, is don't start your car, don't use your cell phone, and just, you know, run away.
Many things play into how people perceive risk, according to David Ropeek, who studied some of the biggest fear factors. And pipelines hit on a lot of them. For one thing, he says people rarely get to choose whether a pipeline will run through their property. Companies like Energy Transfer Partners are often granted eminent domain.
Pipelines are imposed on us. We don't volunteer to have one built under our house or near our house. If we did, we wouldn't be as afraid.
And the Mariner East project is a set of export pipelines. So a lot of Pennsylvanians are being asked to live next door to something that may not bring them benefits, but carries a risk. Also, if something goes wrong, it could be devastating.
We overfear low probability risks if they cause us to die in really nasty ways.
Researchers call this the dread factor.
We freak out about shark attacks. They're not likely to happen.
But it can happen. On average, sharks kill about 6 people globally each year. A man was killed in Massachusetts.
The attack happened on a stretch of the Cape Cod National Seashore.
In the U.S., pipelines have killed an average of 17 people per year and injured 65 per year over the past 2 decades.
It's not the odds of dying, it's the nature of how you get dead. And being blown up or burning to death carries the awfulness factor.
As a former journalist turned author and consultant, Ropeek has advised groups including the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and pipeline companies about how humans perceive risk. He also says it matters if we trust the other people involved.
So if a risk comes from somebody we trust, it won't bother us as much as if it comes from somebody we don't trust. And the fossil fuel industry has been painted as super uber bad guys.
Situations can seem scarier if we don't feel in control, according to Stephen Brumell, an associate professor of social and decision sciences at Carnegie Mellon University. Think about flying in an airplane, which is statistically a very safe thing to do, versus driving a car. Fatal crashes kill tens of thousands of people on U.S. roadways every year.
When you're driving a car, you have the wheel in your hands, and you may feel like you're such a great driver that you can remove yourself from dangerous situations.
But even the best driver can't control the behavior of the other people on the road.
And it's that feeling of control that is really the key. It's not about whether you're actually in control.
It also matters whether a risk feels familiar or unfamiliar. The less people know about something, the scarier it can seem. But riskiness often can mean more to people than simply looking at the probability of fatalities. No matter what the statistics are, Brumell says people need to be heard.
The perceptions that people have should be treated as valid. And what we need to understand is why they feel that way before we can figure out if it's right or wrong to feel that way.
Back on his farm in Lebanon County, Stober is not happy about the Mariner East pipeline, and he's joined a local group fighting it. But he said he doesn't lay awake at night over the possibility of it hurting him personally. He's more worried about the bigger global threat of burning fossil fuels, climate change.
That's what really troubles me, and it's cooking the planet right now.
Whether a pipeline leaks and contributes greenhouse gases or blows up in a terrifying fireball, people will interpret threats differently. But the risks are real. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
A training program to teach veterans to farm lavender on land that had been strip mined didn't go the way participants expected.
They're supposed to give each vet 2 acres of land. And we went to the school, graduated the school, and went to go talk about the land, and nothing. No callback, no email return, nothing.
Later on the Allegheny front, disappointment and misunderstanding over a green economic development plan in coal country. Stay tuned. Thank you. residents in the Pittsburgh suburb of Plum spoke out against a proposed fracking waste injection well recently. At a public hearing, residents said they were worried about water contamination, truck traffic, and the possibility that the well could cause earthquakes. But the company's officials said seismic activity was unlikely. Ben Wallace of Penico Environmental Solutions said injection wells can cause earthquakes, but he said his company's well would not be putting enough fluid underground to cause one.
While this well is permitted at 54,000 barrels a month, that's actually a very low volume well in terms of wells that produce seismic activity.
The facility will process fracking waste that contains radioactive material, salts, and heavy metals. Much of the wastewater from Pennsylvania's fracking industry is actually trucked across the border to Ohio. More than a billion gallons of frack waste, with almost half coming from Pennsylvania and West Virginia, were injected into underground wells in Ohio just last year. And residents in at least one county say they've had enough. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant has more.
Michelle Gurman used to marvel at the 22 acres of land around her home in Vienna, Ohio, less than 10 miles from the Pennsylvania border.
I would lean out my back window and look and say, oh my God, you know, I've never dreamed of owning this much land.
Gurman didn't know much about fracking then, let alone frack waste injection wells, but she remembers New Year's Eve 2011 when a magnitude 4 earthquake shook nearby Youngstown.
Oh my God.
That's a YouTube clip by a Youngstown resident. Around a dozen smaller quakes followed. The state determined that these quakes were from an injection well. That's where fracking wastewater is trucked in and pumped into deep wells under high pressure. The well believed to have caused the Youngstown quakes has since been permanently closed. But Garman's view really changed in 2013 when an injection well was built on the property right next door.
You're looking at tanks and cement and fencing. It was trees and deer and turkey.
Gurman says big trucks carrying chemical-laced wastewater squeal in at all hours. Today, you can hear the pump from her yard. And Gurman fears for her family.
How does it affect our health, my son's health? I mean, it is toxic, what they're putting in. I mean, that is plain and simple poison that they're pumping into the ground.
Gurman says her concerns didn't get much response from the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, known as ODNR, the agency with authority over the oil and gas industry. And few leaders in Vienna wanted to criticize the local company, Cleese Development Associates, that built the well next to her. But then,
state agencies are looking into an oil spill in Vienna Township that killed dozens of animals and polluted a wetland.
It was another injection well owned by Cleese. Gurman says neighbors contacted her for help.
People were scared. Can I drink the water? Can I bathe my children in it? Can I cook with it?
In Ohio, there's no local control of the oil and gas industry. The ODNR is in charge. The state forced Cleese to shut in the injection well, and it's still closed. The company could not be reached for comment. This day, leaders from townships in Trumbull County are gathered at the gazebo in Brookfield Town Square. Brookfield Township Trustee Gary Leese is coaching people to send letters to lawmakers in Columbus.
This goes to the House.
They want legislation that would stop more injection wells in Trumbull County, which already has 17, among the most in the state, with 6 more in the works. State Representative Glenn Holmes is here. He says people are fed up and references a petition against a plan for 5 injection wells in Brookfield Township.
We need about 8,000 people with 5,000 signatures. They don't want it.
Holmes has 2 bills in the Ohio House of Representatives. One, introduced last spring, would divert more than a third of the fees Ohio collects from other states' frack waste disposal to local governments. Last year, fees for this waste brought in more than $650,000. Holmes says counties should get a cut.
So you have the truck traffic, you have the noise, and you also have the stress and the tensions. Is this going to cause an earthquake? Is my aquifer or my well going to be polluted because of this?
More recently, Holmes introduced another bill to stop ODNR from permitting any more injection wells in Trumbull County. Ted Alk doesn't think that's a good idea. He's with the nonprofit Frack Tracker Alliance. He worries that a cap per county would actually open up more of the state to injection wells. And Alk says money from fees should be spent on inspectors.
You can't have your number of inspectors be static and your number of wells go up, up, and away, because that means the ratio of number of wells per inspector is going up.
Alk warns that Ohio has become a dumping ground for other states fracking wastewater. The ODNR says it has strong regulations for injection wells, but declined an interview for this story, as did the Ohio Oil and Gas Association. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
This week on our Trump on Earth podcast, we're featuring a special bonus episode from another podcast we've been enjoying lately, Democracy Works. It's produced by Penn State's McCourtney Institute for Democracy, and it aims to rise above the daily news grind to take a broader look at issues impacting democracy. In this episode, an interview with one of the most vocal climate scientists, Michael Mann. Mann talks about how climate skeptics sometimes react to hearing him speak.
And more often, it's not, you've convinced me. It's, you've got me thinking now. And really, that's all we can hope for. That's what we want them to do.
That's at TrumpOnEarth.org, DemocracyWorksPodcast.com, or search Democracy Works wherever you get your podcasts. Industrial hemp used to be widely grown in Pennsylvania until it was outlawed with marijuana in the 1930s. Now a new effort in Congress might legalize the crop. And WITF's Rachel McDevitt reports researchers in the Commonwealth have been busy studying which varieties will work best for farmers.
Industrial hemp can be grown for a number of uses: seeds for food, fiber for clothing or building material, and cannabidiol oil for health products. Researchers at Penn State's Southeast Agricultural Research and Extension Center in Lancaster County have been looking at what varieties of the plant are best for seed production and the best factors for growing those varieties. Director Alyssa Collins says they found the plants benefited from planting dates earlier in the summer and from nitrogen fertilizer. She says they hope to continue the research next year to confirm the results and to start exploring engineering challenges the crop presents.
We would like to look at different ways of harvesting, and can we develop equipment that's better at harvesting? And from there, how do we process it?
Collins says because of their location, the work done in Lancaster County can apply to growers in the entire Mid-Atlantic region. Similar efforts are underway in 22 other counties. Rachel McDevitt, Raffo Township, Lancaster County.
Earlier this year, we brought you a story about an economic development project to grow lavender on former strip mines in West Virginia. After the story aired, Roxy Todd, the reporter on the story, heard from a number of students involved in the program who said they were disappointed and felt misled by the outcomes of the project, called green mining. So Roxy Todd of West Virginia Public Broadcasting revisited the story to find out what happened and if the project is still going as expected.
First, some background. Back in 2014, then-West Virginia Governor Earl Ray Tomlin asked the West Virginia Regional Technology Park to come up with some ideas that could help generate new jobs for displaced coal miners in southern West Virginia. The idea that the CEO of the technology park, Rusty Krusiluk, had was to grow lavender on former strip mines.
The project for the green mining project was one way that we thought that we could help take displaced mine workers and instead of a mining for coal, perhaps work on mine reclamation.
In 2016, the project was awarded grants through the Benedum Foundation, then the Appalachian Regional Commission, to fund the first couple of years of the green mining program. In the interest of full disclosure, both of these organizations have also provided funding to West Virginia Public Broadcasting. 17 other companies also donated time and resources toward the first phase of the Lavender Project. The Technology Park offered classes to teach people how to grow lavender, and they paid the students a $10 an hour stipend to attend classes. The project attracted 47 students in 2017, including several from out of state.
So we sold everything we owned, packed up our little car, drove 9 hours to West Virginia.
Veterans Deborah and her husband Scott Ritchie moved to West Virginia from Florida with their daughter because they heard about the green mining program.
Came here to be lavender farmers. We were supposed to get a deal to where once we graduate the school, they were supposed to give each vet, because both of us are vets, they're supposed to give each vet 2 acres of land. And we went to the school, graduated the school, and went to go talk about the land, and nothing. No call back, no email return, nothing.
They say they were told that following the 6-week course, they would have the option of growing lavender on a mine site to help raise some supplemental income. But that didn't happen.
I definitely learned not to put all my eggs in one basket, that's for sure. We pretty much put all our eggs in this basket, and the basket got knocked off the table.
Other students we spoke to said they had also been led to believe that they would be offered land to grow lavender on after their 6-week training course. Another veteran, Amber Stanley, lives just outside Charleston. She has a small garden, some chickens, and was looking forward to the opportunity to grow lavender up on the mine site.
Now I'm feeling pretty misled. And I also feel a little bit exploited.
So what happened? The project's main organizer, Rusty Krusilak, says the grant money simply ran out. They couldn't pay their staff anymore, so they couldn't continue the next phase of the project. I asked him what about the students who say they're disappointed, people like Amber, Scott, and Deborah.
We apologize if that's the impression. We weren't aware of that, but We certainly reached out in the springtime to as many people as we could, but we'll do everything we can to rectify that in the future.
An hour after we recorded this interview with Krusilak, a volunteer with the Green Mining Project did send an email to the former students asking if they would want to be a part of a new phase of their project, a lavender growing cooperative. The students from last year's class we talked to all said it was the first time they had heard from the program in 7 months. The idea behind the cooperative, in part, is to get former students to help maintain the existing lavender fields as volunteers. I visited the mine site to see how the plants had fared through the winter.
It's pretty quiet up here on the mine site. Not a lot of people. Black bear crossed in front of our path earlier, down below on the road. And we have some bullfrogs here in a little pond with cattails.
Not far from the cattail pond, the gray moonscape soil now has some purple growing on it. Nearly a year since I was here last, small plants of English and French varieties of lavender dot the rocky fields. A little over 3,000 of the lavender plants survived the winter. Krusilak says that's about half of what they planted last year. A few volunteers, and at least one person who's been paid part-time, has been up here in the past few months weeding the fields. Most of that weeding work has been done by Lori Bailey. She heard about the Lavender Project from a news story and reached out to see how she could get involved.
I was like, that is so cool. I mean, I just thought it was the greatest thing. Because there's so much land that's had mountaintop removal, and I just think it's great that trying to do something to make that look beautiful again.
But without Bailey and a handful of volunteers up here, the lavender plants might have been overtaken by weeds. That's still a risk if they don't find a way to keep the volunteers engaged or figure out how to pay people to keep maintaining these fields.
The last thing you want to do is go out and plant 2,000, 10,000 acres and then not have anybody to work it or not have anybody take care of it.
This is from an interview we recorded last year with one of the project's main organizers, Marina Sawyer.
If we don't have the the workforce or the students coming out to do that kind of work, then you end up losing valuable plants, and that we're not about that either.
But a few months after this interview, Sawyer and the other staff were all let go because they were only contracted to work on a 1-year grant, and the funding ran out. We reached out to the Appalachian Regional Commission, which funded the project last year, to ask them if they're happy with the project's outcomes. They didn't want to do an interview, But Wendy Wasserman, Director of Communications, sent the following statement. This project proves that Appalachia's coal-impacted communities are well-positioned for innovative economic development. The green mining team identified an asset, did the research, and literally got their hands dirty. Now a series of new value-added products using Appalachian-grown lavender are headed to market, end quote. Wasserman says the project was turned down for a second round of funding from the ARC because so many other projects applied for funding, and the application process was incredibly competitive this year. Meanwhile, Rusty Krusilak says that in a few years, he hopes these fields of lavender will be producing enough essential oil that they can earn some income for the project.
Well, most of our revenue down the road is going to be using shared processes once we get oil production. We're going to use the shared revenues to make the whole foundation self-sustaining.
And the technology park does have the equipment and the chemical expertise to produce that oil. But they won't be producing very much oil anytime soon, not for at least another year or two, until the lavender plants are big enough. So in the meantime, how will the project support itself, maintain the fields of lavender? Krusilak says although they didn't receive a second year of funding from the ARC's Power Plus program, he says they are going to try again later this fall. And he says the handful of volunteers will help keep it going. At this time, there are about 5 students still involved helping see the project grow. Not among them is Deborah and Scott Ritchie, who say they just don't know if they have trust in the program anymore.
So for me, this was a new chapter, new leaf, a new adventure, and I just got shot down. And it kind of put me back to that, well, why am I even trying thought process. So I was angry. I was real angry and disappointed.
She says it was nice to see the recent email that the project hasn't gone completely underground, but they don't have time to spend volunteering on the mine site, not at this time anyway. At this point, the Ritchies are just struggling to pay their own bills. Deborah got a job at a gas station, and her husband Scott is still looking for a job. They say they aren't sure if they'll stay in West Virginia or if they plan to leave the state in search of work. I'm Roxy Todd.
That story comes to us from West Virginia Public Broadcasting's podcast, Inside Appalachia. Check out the Inside Appalachia podcast this week to hear more stories about economic development and how people in Appalachia are trying to find ways to bring more jobs to coal country. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.